The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now we come to the fourth section of the course, and we begin to deal with the emergence of the personality ideal in conscious opposition to the science ideal. Now, before, what we have been doing is looking at the idea of freedom within the aegis of the science ideal. Again, that means that within humanistic thought, the idea took hold that freedom, that human freedom, is found by way of well-founded knowledge. You have scientia, or well-founded knowledge. And just that is then the meaning of the word science as it is being used here, not science in the sense simply of natural science, but science in the sense of a well-founded knowledge. And we also found that this well-founded knowledge was considered to be of mathematical character, mathematical in character. Well, now we find a pattern that emerged that is still very influential with the contemporary philosophy and theology. Namely, an ideal of personality that does not seek itself then within well-founded knowledge, but finds itself then in conscious opposition to it. Human freedom then is sought in conscious opposition to the ideal of science. Now, the philosophies of Immanuel Kant and Johann Gottlieb Fichte, F-I-C-H-T-E, both the philosophies of Kant and Fichte fall within this pattern. If we think of the philosophy of Hegel, okay, or Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, H-E-G-E-L. If we think then of the philosophy of Hegel, we find a more complicated expression of this. More recently, this same tendency has been expressed in hermeneutical philosophy, as it is called, as it obtains its inspiration from Wilhelm Dilthey, that's D-I-L-T-H-E-Y, Wilhelm, or William in English, Dilthey, D-I-L-T-H-E-Y. Now, this same attitude has suffused modern theology and contemporary theology. I'm thinking of liberal theology here. It has suffused modern and contemporary liberal theology, as that theology has drawn from the idealistic and existential traditions, and in this case we can mention the modern liberal theologians, Friedrich Schleiermacher, as S-C-H-L-E-I-E-R-M-A-C-H-E-R, Schleiermacher, and Albrecht Ritschl, R-I-T-S-C-H-L. So if you look at modern philosophy, if you look at modern theology, if you look at contemporary philosophy and theology, you see an influence of this pattern, the pattern we are going to be exploring, namely the personality ideal in conscious opposition to the science ideal. Now, this pattern had rather simple beginnings. And it then gained in profundity. It penetrated into thought in a very deep fashion, gained in profundity. It gained in complexity until it issued in the thought of Hegel. But its beginning was in the thought of Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and we shall then look at Rousseau first of all. And so we first look at Jean-Jacques Rousseau. His last name is capital R-O-U-S-S-E-A-U. And his first name is Jean, capital J-E-A-N. And the middle one, Jacques, capital J-A-C-Q-U-E-S. So we turn to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and his dates are 1712 to 1778. 1712 to 1778. Now, in this picture, Rousseau is a transition figure. He broke with what we have been calling the science ideal, or the ideal of science. On the other hand, he did not give this break, this transition in him did not take on a systematic philosophical expression. He did not give it then a systematic philosophical expression. Now, important to this is that for Rousseau, the methods which draw on the mathematical sciences no longer open the way to human dignity and freedom. That was the essence of the science ideal. Now he denies this. The methods that draw from the mathematical sciences no longer open the way then to human dignity and freedom. How, he asks, can the ponderous machinery of theoretical science aid these human ideals? You have ideals of freedom, human dignity. How can this ponderous machinery of science, of theoretical science, aid these human ideals? For Rousseau, virtue and wisdom are engraved on the simple heart. You don't have to go through all this falderal to get to human and dignity, human freedom and dignity, because these then are engraved then on the simple heart. And so it is said that Rousseau developed a view based on sentiment, on feeling or sentiment. Science, he thought, is dangerous. It's dangerous both as to the objects it proposes, and it is still more dangerous as to the effects it produces. So what it aims at is dangerous, and also what comes out of it is dangerous, is even more dangerous. And so everyone should turn to himself in simplicity in order to listen to the voice of conscience. You don't turn to all this edifice, but you turn simply to your conscience. You listen to your voice of conscience. Now, thus we observe the emergence of an idea of personality that stands opposed to the idea that it is through theoretical knowledge, through scientia, that freedom will be realized. And so this viewpoint, the viewpoint of Rousseau, takes its stance against entanglement of personality with nature, as nature is construed deterministically by mathematically oriented science. If you think of nature, then, is that which is able to be construed mathematically as it is subject, determined by cause-effects relationships and so forth. Rousseau view of personality takes its stance against this. It is against the entanglement of personality with nature as it is construed deterministically by mathematically oriented science. In contrast, then, Rousseau develops a different view of nature. He then goes and reinterprets nature. What he does, if I'm not badly mistaken, is take a view of reason that has been present within the humanistic thought, and he applied this to nature. He identifies nature then with the substance of reason, that in nature itself there is reason, there is this substance, reason. And he holds that one has access to this through intuition. You don't have it then by a scientific kind of reasoning, you don't have it then by some well-founded knowledge, but you can have a direct relationship to it then through intuition. If this be the case, then what he said distinguishes man from the animal is not thought. Animals too have reason to a certain extent in the sense of able to figure things out, reason in that sense. In the sense we're talking about it, intellect then simply becomes a higher instance of the sensory association which we also find in the animal. Sometimes it's possible to observe animals solving simple problems. Opening a door in order to get to food, or something of the sort, or taking a stick in order to knock something down so they can get it. Using simple tools in order to solve problems. Well, is it the case that human reason then, or human intellect, and this sense of reason, simply means a higher instance of sensory association which is also present in the animal? Now, if we're going then to distinguish man from the animal, to find out then that which is unique about man, we have to look elsewhere. We cannot look here, but we have to look elsewhere. And where he found this boundary is significant. He said, man differs from the animal because of his quality of being a free agent. It lies in his sense. It lies in his feeling of freedom and moral power. So it is a free being, as a person who has a moral sensibility. This is what then characterizes man as over against the animal. Now, according to Rousseau, the animal lives in a closed order of nature. Animal's not free then. He lives in a closed order of nature. Like the animal, man has natural impulses. Nevertheless, he senses within himself the freedom either to accede to these impulses, either to go along with these impulses, or to resist them. He has a choice here. He can either go along or he can resist these impulses, and it is here that resides the spirituality of man. This is man's spirituality. This is the spirit in man, that he is able to do this. And in the power of willing and choosing, there resides something that cannot at all be explained, he says, in terms of mechanical laws. Now, if we looked at the earlier people under the aegis of the science ideal, we saw that the mechanical model was very widespread. There was a widespread use of a mechanical model in explaining the world. But he says, Rousseau says, there resides something in willing and choosing that cannot at all be explained in terms of mechanical laws. And so the seat of human dignity and worth is here the sentiment of freedom, the sense or this sentiment of freedom. And personality for Rousseau then becomes rooted in feeling. Look for the center of personality. It becomes rooted in freedom, and here science may not encroach. Science may not encroach on this area. Now, Rousseau then turned away from Western culture, where science dominates, to what he imagined was primitive innocency. And on the other hand, he said that in our culture, science had not brought man freedom, but he had brought man slavery and exploitation. I believe there was a question here.
I'm looking at this.
What would you, the question then is whether or not framers of our Constitution may have drawn on some ideas like this because of the fact that there are parallel statements within our Constitution itself. Now, do you have anything more particularly in mind? My understanding of it, it probably would be more an influence of a person like John Locke, wouldn't it, than in Lockean thought? Because you do have ideas of certain inalienable ideas of freedom and so forth. And that's the direction I would turn. Now, I don't have any idea, at least it's never come to my attention, that there would be an influence of Rousseau. On the other hand, Rousseau was one who dealt with the idea of contract and these things too. And that, of course, is important among the thoughts of the men who formed our country. Well, that is something that might be interesting to look into further, but I have associated the founding fathers and these things with some other lines of thought, but you may have a point there. Now let's look a little bit more, though, at this idea of primitive innocency and the rejection then of this science ideal. This Rousseauian view of nature is indeed expressed clearly in various personages, in various movements. I refer to the artist Gauguin, capital G-A-U-G-I-N. If I understand correctly, Gauguin left what he regarded as the artificialities of European civilization in order to find unspoiled nature in the islands of the South Sea. If I understand also correctly, that he was disappointed to find out that Christian missionaries had gotten there first and had spoiled things for him, because bringing in their, what from his point of view and Rousseauian point of view would be the conventionalities of religion and morality into what otherwise might have been an unspoiled state of nature. Well, this view is expressed in Gauguin's painting, D'où venons-nous, qu'est-ce sont-nous, and où allons-nous? Where have we come from, who are we, and where are we going? I looked at that painting very, very carefully while I was up at the Boston Art Gallery not terribly long ago. And the painting expresses supposedly the shameless, unblushing naturalness of the human body. You have on the one side, you have the young child, and then you have a couple of maidens in the full bloom of youth standing there unashamedly, nakedly and unashamedly. But then over to the left, you have an old woman who is shriveled up in her old age and is covering herself in shame because of the fact that her body is no longer beautiful. But the supposed a naturalness, a supposed an expression of naturalness here, unblushing naturalness in these women. That, it seems to me, is a Rousseauian theme. And as we remember, in Rousseau, then, an idea of nature, and that reason is in nature. And so the expression in these girls' bodies would be expression of nature, an expression of reason, and there is a religious thrust in this too. And over against the conventionalities. And so if a person were to come in and to say, express certain moral judgments or religious judgments about this, then he would belong to those who are conventional and have missed the freshness and directness and trueness that comes to us from unspoiled nature. Well, we've also had Rousseauian themes in the counterculture of the 1960s. In this country, I may have mentioned already in the course about those whose slogan was doing what comes naturally. Just do that which comes by impulse, doing that which is naturally, comes naturally. Well, if you have a Rousseauian idea of sentiment and feeling, you'd say, well, the inclination to do here, what I feel like doing is expresses something deeper. It expresses a reason. It expresses a natural reason. And I often refer to a rather old film now called Hurricane, in which there is this island in this, I gather, the South Seas, to which Christian missionaries have come and they built a church. And there are certain trappings of civilization on this. A great, great hurricane blows up and a tremendous tidal wave washes over the island. And the only two persons from this whole group who survive are a man and a woman who lashed themselves to a huge tree. And the tree is uprooted and carried off by the hurricane, but they survive, and they survive then to come back and paddle off to another island to start a new culture. In the meanwhile, Christians, those who, in this view, serve conventional religion, have crowded into the church, but the roof of the church caves in and kills all of them, and they are swept away by the tidal wave. So the tidal wave sweeps away trappings of civilization and religion, leaving only two survivors to erect a new population. And it seems to me that this also reflects a Rousseauian theme of nature. You can have the idea of exploring human emotions, exploring human situations after the quote-unquote artificialities of civilization have been forgotten or have then been set aside and you have then, you've been reduced then to bare nature. Well, at any rate, that is definitely a Rousseauian theme. And even though this theme recurs in modern film, in contemporary film, in modern contemporary art, it was not worked out, as I say, by Rousseau, and not worked out by many persons in a systematic fashion. But the pattern basically is this, that conventionalities are brought into being by human willing using the means of science and invention. And these then have brought man not the freedom he looked for, but have brought him slavery and have brought in exploitation. And one has to leave these things behind and get back to nature and do what comes naturally. But that is not some kind of simple, wild extravagance, but is regarded then doing what comes naturally is regarded then to be an expression of not only nature, but the reason then that infuses nature. Well, a person who took a Rousseauian theme and gave it a very elaborate and fine exposition was Immanuel Kant, capital K-A-N-T, Immanuel Kant. And his dates are 1724 to 1805. Now, as we turn to Kant, we are dealing then with a thinker for whom the ultimate source of assurance and the ultimate guarantee of human dignity and worth are not found in knowledge. In that, he follows Rousseau. Not found in knowledge patterned after the model of the mathematical sciences of nature. But unlike Rousseau, Kant did not discover the seat of human personality in a deepened sensibility. That's where Rousseau found it, what we can call a deepened sensibility. Sensibility here is not just any old thing you happen to feel, of course, but that there is a deepened sensibility, a fine feeling, a deepened sensibility, which then is the foundation of your dignity and freedom. Kant did not simply find the seat of human personality in a sense of morality and virtue engraved on the heart. Nevertheless, he did turn away from the science ideal, what we have been calling the science ideal, and this is expressed in his famous dictum that he had limited science in order to make room for faith. Kant said, and that's very well known, that he had limited science in order to make room for faith. Now, in his critique of theoretical thought, his critique of pure reason, Kant, as is well known, had in mind to save science then from the dissolution threatening it because of the psychologism of David Hume. We saw that in David Hume, he took an empiricism which had come to him in the empirical tradition, and David Hume took that and he drove it then to his extreme. He took it to an extreme. He landed up in a thoroughgoing psychologism. And Immanuel Kant attempted to save science from the dissolution threatened by this psychologism. He admitted the validity of Hume's assertion that one is unable to arrive at the unity of the world and of the self by way of abstraction from the data of sense. You'll remember that Hume reduced everything to impressions and then the faint images of these impressions as we have them in ideas. And we found that along that route, there was a loss. He lost the possibility of understanding the unity of the self and the unity of the world. Now Kant says, yes, if you go this route, if you go along this route, and you seek then to arrive at the unity of the world and the self by way of abstraction from what is given to you in your sense experience, from the data of sense, you will most certainly fail. And Hume, then, what he tried to do shows us that. Instead, Kant says, even though we are dependent upon our sense experience, we find that our experience is organized in terms of something that is already there in it. There's something that is already there, certain forms that are already there. If you have the material of sense, you have certain forms in the mind which are already there and that organize our experience. So as we experience, our experience is already organized in certain ways. These forms then are laid in the mind. They reside in the mind and they organize our experience. Now for Kant, there were two kinds or two sorts. There were the forms then of the sense experience, and there were the forms of the understanding, sense and understanding. There were the forms then of sense and the forms of understanding. He distinguished these two. And furthermore, he distinguished two forms of sense, two forms of our sense experience. In the first place, space, which is the form of our outer experience. As we look outside ourselves in our outer experience, we observe everything within space. And then time, which is the form then of our inner experience. We look inside. We do not see spatial configurations, but we experience things in time. And so you have the two forms of sense, which are space and time. Now the forms of the understanding are logical forms such as cause and effect, substance and accident. And so as we look try to understand things, we find that we understand them in terms of these forms. We have to understand things in terms of cause and effect, substance and accident, and so forth. These then are forms of the understanding under which we subsume our experience. And these forms of the understanding are logical, he says, logical in character. Now, according to Kant, the forms of sense and of the understanding are not abstracted from our variegated experience. We may indeed abstract, draw off from our experience, abstract from it, but if we do so, we're already then under the control, we are already in our experience dependent upon these forms. So they are not themselves abstracted from our variegated experience. They are what underlie our experience and make it possible. They lie at the foundation of our experience and make this experience possible. And as soon as we say something like this, we have to add the thought that this is what Kant means by transcendental. That these are transcendental forms which underlie our experience and make it possible. And as we experience, they are already present, as I said. Thus, as we experience things, we experience them in space. And this space is not another thing besides the many things we experience, but it's the form in which all of our experience comes to us. Is space another thing out there? No. He says it's the form within which all our experience comes to us. The same is true of time as a form of sense. It is then not just another thing that we experience looking within ourselves, but it is the form in which our inner experience manifests itself. The same is also true of the categories. It's the form of understanding. We use cause and effect and so forth. These are not something over and above, but they are then the forms in which then we understand. Now, if experience then is possible, according to Kant, it is only then because of the contribution a priori of the forms of sense and of the understanding. And when we use the word a priori, one can simply say that this is prior to experience. Something a priori is prior to experience. One might say, I sometimes put it this way, it's before the fact. But here perhaps we better say that a priori here means that there's something there prior to our experience. Now, if they are there, Kant taught, these forms are empty apart from the contribution of sense experience. They accompany our sense experience, they affect our experience, they form our experience, but they cannot be considered then apart from our experience. Apart from our sense experience, they are empty apart from the contribution of sense experience. They are empty apart from the material or the stuff of our sense experience. And so he said, concepts without percepts are empty. We have concepts in our mind, and we do not relate those concepts to that which we perceive, then we find that these are empty. But on the other hand, the stuff of sense experience without concepts, without such concepts of cause and substance, is lacking in meaning. It lacks in direction. It is an unorganized, rather meaningless congeries of things that we experience. And so he said this, percepts, or that which we then perceive, without concepts, are blind. On the one hand, you have then concepts without percepts are empty, and on the other hand, percepts without concepts are blind. And so Kant taught that experience is a combination of formal and material elements. The matter of it, or the material elements of it in our experience, and then the formal elements, the forms that are already there and that affect our experience not only, but make that a very experience possible. So neither one is able to exist without the other. Now, that Kant related experience to both of these elements meant that he denied that one can come to an ultimate unity by way of experience. You always have these together, and you cannot then come to an ultimate unity simply by way of experience. If this were to be possible, one would have to exhaust experience. One would have to come to a complete understanding of its object, what he has in his mind out here, what is most often called object. One would have to come to a complete understanding of the object of thought. He would have to come then to an understanding of things as they are in themselves, as they are in the German an sich, or in themselves. And this, Kant said, is beyond our reach. We cannot then get this ultimate unity, we are unable to obtain to the unity of thought and being. In our thinking, we are unable to get to this complete unity. We are unable to bridge the gap between thought and being. Now, in tying understanding to sense, by indicating inability to exhaust the manifold of experience, Kant took a stance against the ascription of creative power to the understanding. Now, as we're presenting this history, one of the themes that was prominent under the aegis of the science ideal was that your mathematical type thinking had a creative power. One of the ideas is that it's able to break down things, it's able then in a process of resolution or analysis, to break things down and then to build them up again, creatively build them up again. But Kant takes a stance against the ascription of creative power to the understanding, this which is called the spontaneity of the understanding, as this had been then conceived by the mathematically oriented science ideal. And he undermined hereby the possibility of rooting human personality in mathematical science. There was an undermining here of this mathematical ideal of science and the possibility of rooting human personality in mathematical science. Now, in this, Kant looked for a basis of unity along a different path. I've already suggested the direction in which he sought that when I used the word transcendental. Let us review just a moment what is meant here by transcendental. That transcendental has to do that with that which then lies at the very foundation of the possibility of something. And furthermore, that as you look at this thing, which it makes possible, it doesn't underlie it simply as if you were to look at a house and then its foundation. That image is not entirely beyond the place. But as you look at the thing, then you penetrate into it and you see, even by looking at it and penetrating into it in depth, you see what is at the very basis or the foundation of his possibility. Now, Kant wanted to look in such a transcendental direction. And he said, if we're going to understand the unity of man in his wholeness and unity, and if we're going to find the key then to understanding man in his dignity and freedom, we have to look in a transcendental direction. He said, accompanying each of our judgments, each of the judgments of our understanding, is a formal I think. I think this, I think that, I think the other. So if you then lop off the objects, all the possible objects of thought, as they are called, then you are left with this formal I think. Every object I experience is for my mind, which thinks it. It must be related to a formal I think. So in Kant's thought, there is a turn toward the I, a turn toward the ego. But in this regard, it is simply a turn toward the I taken as a formal logical unity, a formal logical unity. The forms of the understanding are logical in character. They are forms. It's a formal, logical unity, what is called a unity of apperception, apperception. If you think of your perception, you look out at the world and you perceive things. You have these percepts, as we are calling them. But if you then look inward and at that which You reflect on then as you have your perception, as you think about things in the world, let's say, that we would call apperception. That's what called apperception. And what he then turns to is a formal logical unity of apperception which accompanies all of our thought. Now, if one does not proceed in this fashion, Kant said, and if one seeks to arrive at an ultimate basis of unity along the way of experience, abstracting from experience, he will fall into antinomy. Now, an antinomy is nomos here, antinomy, nomos, law, and anti is against, something which then is against law. An antinomy is a contradiction which arises that cannot then be simply solved, cannot simply be gotten out of the way by thinking more clearly and by being more logical. There is something which gives rise to the antinomy, which itself must be removed if the antinomy is going to be removed. When one asks Constant about the final unity of the world, the self or the totality of experience, namely God, you run into these antinomies. When one asks whether the soul is divisible or indivisible, when one asks whether the world is infinite or finite, one runs into this antinomy type things, or to what Kant also called paralogisms. Or if one seeks to establish by proof the existence of God, he lands in contradictions which cannot be eliminated by way of further logical clarification. You just can't be smarter, you just can't be clearer in your thinking and remove these. These are not then on the order of simple logical contradictions. On the other hand, they are indicators. They're signals to us. They're signals given to us that we have then committed a fundamental error. We've made a fundamental mistake. Because what we have been doing is pushing thought beyond the boundaries that are appropriate to it. And so, if we push thought beyond the limits, then the machinery is going to break. You can't take your race car and just push it all out for the entire race. Otherwise, something is going to give. Thought here has been pushed beyond the boundaries appropriate to it. And what that means then is if we're going to solve this, what we have to do, as it were, pull in our horns. We have to pull in the horns of thought. If you sometimes a little snail will go along, you know, and it will, its feelers will hit something, and then they will retract. And this, maybe the little snail will retreat into a shell entirely. What has happened, Kant says, is when we run into antinomies, that's a sign to us that thought has been loosed from the confines of sense experience. What we have done is fail. We have refused to limit our thinking to the domain of our sense experience, our empirical, our experience, to the limits of the empirical. We've gone beyond, and the antinomy then arises, which is a sign to us that we've gone beyond, we extended these boundaries, and that we ought to retreat. And so the antinomies at once indicate the boundaries of the understanding and point to the fact that the source of ultimate assurance lies along a different path. We're not going to get to complete assurance along this path, along the sense of experience and thinking, science and so forth. This is a sign to you that that is out, and therefore you have to look along a different path. And this path, this other path, is that which Kant explored in his practical philosophy. We've been looking during this hour at Kant's first critique, the critique of pure reason and certain patterns in that. Kant then, in order to solve this, moves in a direction which was dealt with in his second critique, the critique of practical reason. What he does then is move in explores a practical philosophy. And in doing this, we shall discover that his thought moves in a moral direction. And the moral philosophy of Kant, or the ethical philosophy of Kant, is going to be a very important attempt to preserve personality in the face of the difficulties encountered along the line of mathematical understanding.